market, the S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that hopes to be right at this very instant, recovering from Christmas and Boxing Day in front of the cricket. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, Dr. Nirban Mahati. G'day, Doc.
G'day, Captain.
Merry Christmas. Both an advance and a belated Merry Christmas, mate. We hopefully will see this podcast hit the airwaves on the 27th of December, just after Boxing Day. But of course, we are pre-recording this because you're on the other side of the world. So I guess I'm wishing you a pre and post Merry Christmas. Hopefully it was a good one.
Yeah, well, same for you. Pre
Thank
and
you,
post Merry Christmas and, you know, an advanced New Year, I guess.
Well, that's exactly right. And to our listeners, this is the lull between Christmas and New Year, the time that is best spent watching the cricket, frankly. And as I said, eating some of those Christmas leftovers. If you have some in the fridge, don't let the ham go off. Make sure you've eaten it and you're having a lovely Christmas break. And to our listeners, we hope you had a very Merry Christmas as well, and we hope you're gearing up for the New Year. We do have a special New Year's episode next week, so we'll keep people in suspense for that one. But in the meantime, mate, because we're doing this in advance and because despite our forecasting abilities, despite the wonderful crystal balls we have at our disposal, we don't know what's going to happen in the news, so we don't have any news. We just have a very, very full, so I was going to call it a Christmas, maybe we should call it a Christmas, a foolish Christmas sack. Evoke the images of Santa having finished his trip. We've still got a Santa's sack full of mailbag questions. Should we get on, do you reckon?
Let's dip into the sack.
Beautiful, let's do it.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, before I do, we're not stepping into the sack. We're going to take mail out of the sack, just for the record.
That sounds like a really good
Otherwise,
idea.
We're doing like, you know, sort of potato sack races and it's... Brings me back horrible, horrible memories of being six and at primary school having to do those, you know, those novelty races, the three-legged race and the potato sack race and the egg and spoon race. And that's not a happy memory for me, mate. I'm not an athlete, put it that way.
No, let's not do that.
Should we get out of the questions?
Let's get on.
We had one from Dave, mate, via email. Oh, I forgot last week to do these socials again. I'm supposed to give those details out. I'm getting slack.
But, you know.
Can you remind me at the end?
I will.
All right. So Dave emailed us. Teaser or spoiler alert, okay. info@fool.com.au. They said, guys, enjoy the show, despite most of it not being of value to me being in the US. Well, I think that's a compliment, Dave. If you're actually not getting much out of the show but you still enjoy it, I'll take that as a compliment.
That's definitely a compliment.
Thank you, mate. However, I do have a question that perhaps you have answered before, but it will take me a while to go through all your back issues. Well, Dave, see, here's the thing. You should have listened to them already, mate. Hmm. What else are you doing with it? What could you possibly be doing that's more important? Listen to all of the back episodes of Motley Fool Money.
Absolutely. Go do it. That's the most important thing to do.
Correct. I'm not going to answer his question, right?
I will still answer his question.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
We nice people.
now we've had a couple of questions on this topic, mate. And to be fair, we've actually pre-recorded a couple of episodes. So I can't remember whether the one we've already pre-recorded or one we've already put out. But I think when this goes to air, we will have had the questions about and language warning, slight language warning. We had a question about someone who thought we were being described as dicks within a Porsche. In fact, the line from the Triple M people is not a couple of dicks in a Porsche. So we did clarify that in a previous episode, I think. However, Dave is on the same topic saying, the question relates to the statement, you are not a couple of dicks that drive a Porsche. True. The question is, okay, what do you drive? And we thought this was not exactly investment related, but it is podcast related. And hey, it's post-Christmas, it's pre-New Year, it's in that lull, so why not answer the question? He then says also, P.S., it takes a bit longer to listen to your podcast as I have to listen at 1x speed rather than at 1.5x speed of the other podcasts done in the United States. Cheers, Dave. Dave, apologies. I do not have the vocal dexterity nor sublime listening. What's the word? I'm not as good a listener as Chris Hill, put it that way. Our podcast host extraordinaire in the US is Chris Hill, who has a voice that belongs in some sort of Richard Mercer love god territory and who is lovely to listen to. I'm not Chris Hill. And so I apologize. I also speak too fast, as we well and truly know. And I try every time. Here's a bit of an inside look, Dave. At the top of our script every week, I have in big, bold letters, talk slowly. And I start that way. It just doesn't keep going. All right. So back to Dave's question, because, you know, If there's more tangents than podcasts, mate, are we officially in the wrong classification? Can we officially be an investing podcast if we do more tangents than investing?
We can be the tangent podcast.
The tangent. I mean, there should be a category for those.
Well, it could be a category by itself.
We'd be number one.
And we'd be number one.
Because we'd be the only one there.
Which is great. I love that.
There's no harm in coming first if you're the only person in the race. Speaking of tangents, my only ever school sporting success, I came second in a backstroke race in primary school.
There were two people there?
No, I think there was three, but it still wasn't that great. So I came second last rather than coming second, but that was enough. Somewhere my mother has a red ribbon with second on it that I got in, I think, year five. I think it was year five. That was my first and last great sporting achievement at school,
great.
I have to say.
Great. Well, right. Congratulations.
Thank you. Back to Dave's question. Don't let me get distracted. That's your job. Running me through the socials. You're a busy man. All right. He says, the question is, okay, what do you drive? Now, our loyal listeners, and Dave, not that you're not loyal, but our longer-term listeners are yelling at their listening devices right now. They know the answer. There are hands shooting up all around Australia and in the US where Dave is, and in Singapore and Hungary, as we've already talked about, and London. We heard about that one a couple of weeks ago. Hands up all over the place. But Doc, put Dave out of his misery, mate. What car do you drive?
So I recently got a Tesla Model 3.
There we go.
And I love the question because he says it's a Porsche because my Tesla Model 3 can smoke a Porsche any day. In fact, it can smoke most other nice cars.
Didn't I see recently, though, that the Porsche beat the Tesla? Didn't I see that?
You know, lots of car beats lots of different cars in racetracks. What counts is, do you actually have something on the road that can beat the other cars? And, you know, I'll say this. I love the fact that yesterday while driving at Campbelltown, I saw a very beautiful black Maserati.
Okay.
Beautiful. You know, and I was just back from school. This is a massive tangent, I know. Back from school, picking out the daughter, and my wife was in, and like, I, you know, my daughter said, why are you smiling? I said, I really hope at this time that the Maserati and our car line up at the traffic light. And then we'll see who wins.
And did it?
And no.
Oh.
Because, you know, that would be the greatest joy because the Maserati is a really expensive car. So I've not had the joy of racing a Maserati yet, but I know that, the Tesla Model 3 would smoke the Porsche. So, yeah, that's my answer. Long-winded answer.
There you go. So, Dave, you've made Doc a very happy man. Whenever he gets to talk about his Tesla, he smiles a little bit more brightly. He stands a little bit taller. His blood pressure goes down. He's a happy man, our Doc, when he gets to when he gets to talk about his Tesla.
And my Tesla's waiting to get another software update. There'll be like two software updates in a week.
Man, a proper car company would have only one. They'd only need one, surely.
Well, the proper car company. If it's a proper car company, it would say there's only one software update that you can have, and that software update you really need to come to a dealer for which you need to book an appointment. And guess what? They're going to charge you some really nice dollars for the software update, which is really not going to be really a good software update.
Now, Dave, it was a wonderful question for you to ask because it makes Doc happy, and if Doc's happy, I'm happy. So, you know, that was okay.
Dave, was a great question.
Well, it also coincides with we're recording this on a day when Doc had to pick me up from the station because my car was being dropped in for service, and so he mentioned to me that I probably should have bought a car that doesn't need servicing, and that's possibly fair. It also coincides with our other car had a warning light come on and had to book it in for an unscheduled service. So, look, it's not a great day to be a non-Tesla owner in our place. Just, you know, Doc's come to my place to do the recording. We're doing it from the home studio here, and Doc picked me up from the station on the way, which was kind of him, and I appreciated it. But frankly, it just gave him the opportunity to remind me that I didn't have a Tesla. For the record, we have two cars in our family. We have a Volkswagen Golf and a Toyota Prado. So no Porsches, no sports cars. The Golf is a wonderful little car, by the way. Super, super fuel efficient and great value for money. The Prado takes us places that we want to go. We did Birdsville last year. This year. We're still in 2019. Next year, we're going to head out probably to Wilpena Pound and Uluru. So horses for courses. Doc has convinced me. Actually, I've put my deposit down for a Cybertruck. So Doc's happy about that. Although he secretly, I think, doesn't want me to buy it because that proves that it's worth owning or something. Isn't that the story?
Yeah, it's true.
I'm sure I should be offended by that, mate, but I can't bring myself.
It's like, you know, if you buy the iPhone, Apple is basically dead. It's basically just that, right? So,
It's kind of like Facebook, well, right? By the time the uncool people like me are using it, it's too late and the kids have moved on. No,
I think you should have the Cybertruck so that you know. Yeah, you can look like the cool kid on in Barrow.
Anyway, so yes, they're our cars, Dave. Thank you for the question and thank you for giving Doc the opportunity post-Christmas to, well, to enjoy his Tesla-ness or something. Should we move on?
Yeah, let's move on.
That's our last Tesla. Well, I guess that's our last Tesla question. Whether it's the last mention of Tesla, that's a whole different question that we still haven't resolved yet. Stay tuned.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Next question, mate, came from Billy. And I know that because he says, "Hi, Scott and Doc, it's Billy here again." He said, "The fool who gambled on Carnegie Clean Energy, still waiting for my 0.02 cent buyer." And he smiles. Good luck, Billy. We hope you get it. We're more than happy to be wrong if our listeners are making money despite our concerns. That's okay with us. He says, "Thanks for asking my last question. On your program, I have another one. ZIP announced a round of fundraising back on Black Friday with two tranches of capital raising. One to institutional investors, which they achieved within days, and a $10 million capital raising to existing retail shareholders at $3.70 a share. It was trading at $3.90 a share when it was announced. Since then, however, ZIP has dropped to about $3.52 a share. I'm no longer a shareholder, having sold them when they hit $5 a share." Nice humble brag. Thank you, Billy. "So this is a general question. Firstly, given the seeming ease with which they were able to raise the money with institutions, why is the market so bearish on ZIP? And then secondly, why would an existing shareholder buy shares even without brokerage at $3.70 when they can buy them on the market at $3.52? Thanks, guys. Love the mailbag episodes and full on." Good man, Billy. We love the full on sign off. Thank you, mate. And thank you for being kind about the podcast as well. Doc, certainly Afterpay is a recommendation of one of our services. I think ZipPay might actually be one of our portfolio reports we put out not long ago.
Yeah, I think ZIP is a recommendation in some portfolio service.
So to disclose both of those up front.
Yeah.
All right, so let's go through this. So the basic idea is where they announced the capital raising. The market didn't like it, or at least subsequently the combination of that and whatever other news might have come out saw the share price go down. So to Billy's question, if they were able to raise $50 million with institutions so quickly, how did the market go so bearish?
Well, you know, I think the main thing to note here is that they got the institutional part of the raising done, right? And then what really, you know, if the share price moves backwards, then the retail placement doesn't work because why would you buy the shares at 370?
Which when is
you
the can, question Billy's asked.
Yeah, when you can buy the shares at 350. So, right. I mean, for whatever reason, the market, you know, has cooled down a bit on ZIP. And
Billy's kind of answering that though. Like, why has the market if the instos who are supposedly the smart money are happily gobbling up shares at 370, how does the share then fall to 352?
Well, price? I mean, you know, for one, this entire sector is very volatile, right? So, you know, most of these companies, their share prices move up and down a lot,
right,
on pretty much a day to day basis. So, why does it move 10%? It's like really hard to answer. I mean. Okay.
That's kind of a reminder though that, right, I think to some degree inherent in Billy's question is, well, hang on, the smart money bought it at 370, why is it not worth buying at 352? I think we'd probably say that sometimes the so-called smart money, I don't know, be pejorative about it, but we shouldn't necessarily assume instos are have any particular great insights or abilities that the average investor doesn't have.
Yeah, that's true. Like, I mean, you know, there are thousands of instances where, you know, insiders have sold and the stock has gone up 4x. Mm. There are instances where insiders are sold and the stock has gone to zero, right? I mean, it happens both ways. And yeah, like, I mean, on any of these buy now, pay later, the entire sector, I think, is very volatile. And, you know, I wouldn't assume that the smart money necessarily knows that the stock is going to go up. So, I don't follow ZIP that closely. So okay. I don't have a view on the price per se. But I can totally see why it can fall from, like, you know, 370 to 350. But 370 to 350 is not a big fall.
I guess the inherent in Billy's question is probably, if I ask the question in reverse, if instos are paying 370, shouldn't it be a steal at 350? I mean, if you're an individual shareholder and you're saying, well, hang on, all these guys ponied up $50 million at a higher price, should I be very keen, pretty keen, a bit keen, overwhelmingly keen at a lower share price. I mean, if they're gonna part ways with $50 million at 370, in theory they should like it more at 350, and shouldn't we as well?
Well, it depends on what you think the business is going to be worth, should be worth today, and will be worth in the future, right? I mean, it could be a steal or may not be a steal, right? I mean, that's again,
right?
I think that's a very that's a hard question to answer without really like digging into the business, and I mean, so I know a little bit about Zip. So I mean, there are a couple of things. Zip is not Zip doesn't have those international opportunities yet that Afterpay has. So that's a big difference, right? And I think a company that's leveraged, that's basically a type of credit opportunity that's leveraged to just Australia, is a higher risk proposition than a company that is still a credit company but is leveraged to global opportunities, right?
Okay, so, but Zip's about one-fifth of the market cap. So Zip's at $1.5 billion, Afterpay close to eight. So give me a couple of rounding errors there. About five times the size of Afterpay, admittedly massive opportunity internationally. Is that market cap relativity about right, do you think, on that basis? I mean, some people would say, well, even without the international, Zip should be worth something more than a fifth of Afterpay's value. Other people are saying, well, all the Afterpay upside is in the international expansion. So without international, maybe Afterpay is only itself only worth a couple of $1 billion.
So how much do you say was Zip's?
$1.43 billion.
And Afterpay is about eight.
Eight, yeah.
Eight. So here's another way to think about it, right? So the US market is at least 10x the size of the Australian market.
Yep.
So if you assume that the Australian success translates to US success, I would think that your market cap should be 10x. So in that sense, if you assume that Zip is fairly valued or whatever it is, then maybe Afterpay is undervalued. You know, in that, I mean, you know, you can make an argument either way.
So is Afterpay your favorite of the two?
Yeah. So I mean, in the buy now pay later category, I think Afterpay is the leader.
Right.
And it is growing really fast. It's got lots of traction. Mm. It's getting good traction in the US. It's getting good traction in the UK. And those are really large markets. They've got a senior management team who have come from big companies as well. Mm. So I think the business is really set to grow, despite all the risks it has, I think.
Now, if this was akin, this is a financial services company in the payment space. There's room for MasterCard and Visa and Amex. Maybe there's room for more than one buy now, pay later. And maybe if they both are successful, there's simply more pure headroom for ZipPay in that scenario. Or maybe they're more like social media or social networking where, you know, it's a bit more winner takes all. Is that how you're seeing this particular payment space?
Yeah, like, so the way I look at this payment space, I mean, the payment space is a bit complicated, right? I mean, there are all these different players. So Visa, MasterCard are different in the sense that they basically are the network that allows the payment flows to happen.
Right.
So in a way, everybody needs Visa and MasterCard.
Right.
Right. So they are effectively toll roads. And the way I look at the buy now pay later is buy now pay later basically is another way to provide an FPOS solution. It's basically a solution that you're providing at the point of sale. So it's a point of sale solution, really, effectively, right? Because, and it's in another way, there's many ways in which you can think about this. But, you know, like small businesses, for example, when people pay to small businesses using credit cards and credit cards immediately don't make that money available to the small business, like there's this lag in terms of payments clearing, then there's a cash flow problem. Right. So some companies, for example, provide cash flows to small businesses by basically saying, well, you know, I take the credit card, I assume that the credit card is effectively going to pay, and therefore today I'm going to pay you that money and I'm going to charge you an interest for that.
Yeah, right.
In Afterpay is basically doing something similar, basically saying, well, you know, I'm going to pay the money today and it's going to increase your basket size, and for that I'm going to take a cut from you. Right. It's so there are many ways in which these payment solution companies are providing solutions to retailers, and they're sort of at the end point and not really in the pathway like the Visa and MasterCard are. Right. So I think there's room for multiple different types of solutions.
So are you bearish on Zip or just more bullish on Afterpay?
No, so I'm not bearish on Zip. I think this entire sector can grow. Okay. What, again, like at a certain valuation, Zip is attractive. Zip's, I think, issue is just the market.
Right.
I think it's got a similar product, but, you know, it's got a smaller share in the Australian market. And effectively, I mean, when somebody's offering Afterpay, there is some logic there to believe that they should also offer Zip, right?
Mm. Well, I've certainly seen that point being made widely. If you're a retailer, you don't really care which buy now pay later provider the consumer uses.
Yeah.
So unless one of the providers is giving you a sweetheart deal to have exclusivity, it's like saying no business has Just Visa or Just Mastercard. I mean, some do, I guess, but and to be fair, many don't have Amex, right? So there is an element of we don't take it all, and that's largely a pricing reason. But of course, you're going to offer all credit card or most credit card solutions. You're probably going to. Why turn away a Zip customer just because you don't offer Zip? You might as well offer both, right?
Yeah, but I think this is a little bit of a first mover type of more entrenched opportunity sort of situation going on, right? If most people have accounts with Afterpay, but they don't have account with Zip, then there's an effort required to make for the retailer to actually get them to open a Zip account, you know, get it validated, get them to actually buy or sell via Zip, right?
Right.
And if that's not happening, if more retailers accept Afterpay, then that becomes a self sort of reinforcing thing, because more retailers accept Afterpay, therefore more customers want Afterpay,
right?
And that sort of cycle builds. It's a little bit of a virtuous cycle in that sense, right?
I've always been a little bit surprised, actually, why retailers take both. Well, why Visa and MasterCard both have a place in the market, I have to say. Like, competition's always good. I'm not unhappy that they're there. But at some point, Visa and MasterCard are ironically, given the huge margins they're making, they're kind of commodity services, right? There is no difference between Visa and MasterCard other than just a random choice, right? Like, I happen to have a Visa card in my wallet. It could just easily be a MasterCard. My bank could just easily offer either, the retailer could just easily accept either. To some degree, I'm kind of surprised that both have been able to be as successful in a relatively commoditized space already. You're right, there's no reason why you shouldn't just have Afterpay, but there's no reason why you shouldn't just have Visa either. It's like how do you see that, if it is different? How is it different, or how do you think it might play out in a different way?
Yeah, so some disclosures. I own MasterCard shares. Effectively, I think there are a couple of trends. One is, yes, both provide essentially a payment network.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's not just the fact that they're a payment network. It's the fact that there's this driving trend towards, less cash, more electronic payments. And as the payment volume in total increases for electronic payments, effectively both of these companies are benefiting. So, none of these companies are growing their top line at a huge rate, but they are, effectively very, scalable businesses, right? So as more dollars are flowing through the payment networks, they're basically just making more money.
Yeah.
And, they both have similar, in many ways, take rates, right? The amount of money that they charge, take rate being basically the percentage of the transaction volume that they are taking.
Right? Okay.
So they're basically riding a secular tailwind as we go towards more digital transactions, and eventually, at some day we're going to have digital money.
Right.
These companies basically stand to benefit because, they're just the right companies at the right time.
Sure. But I guess I'm wondering why one hasn't dominated. I mean, think about the Afterpay, ZipPay question. Why, it's curious to me that we haven't seen one or the other of those two networks dominate. And then thinking about how buy now, pay later might evolve.
Yeah.
We could very well see one have 99% of the market. We could, in a different version of the world, have two players with 50% each or something similar, or some other variational combination of both, in the way that Visa and MasterCard have kind of got this, I would say cozy, because it kind of implies some sort of, untoward activity. But, they've got this duopoly that's working very nicely for them.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I mean, again, I think that you have to probably go into the history of this, and I'm not really, you know, that familiar with the history. Like, I mean, both of these payment networks came out of banks, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, so different banking networks created them.
So part of the kind of creation structure, more than
these alternatives that have come out of the banks that have been eventually, you know, like, you know, Visa. I believe, I don't know Visa's story that well, but I think Visa had a European version that was, you know, still owned by banks, which has recently been acquired or sometime back been acquired. So they're effectively byproducts of the banking world. And they were just two competing different offerings that happened to be. And, you know, Amex is slightly different, right? Amex has a network but also provides credit. So Amex is different. Then there are others that have tried to copy this, right? There's Diners and a few others that I forget. There's Diners and something else. So I think first mover actually matters. And, you know, maybe it's a duopoly. Maybe it's a, you know, quadrupoly. I don't know. but I think first mover in something that becomes accepted, I think, is interesting and is important.
Now, let's just quickly cover off the back half of Billy's question and then we'll move on. You kind of inferred it already by your own rhetorical asking the same question he asked, which is, why would an existing shareholder buy shares even without brokerage at 370 when they can buy them on the market at 352?
And the answer is they won't, right? Which is why they didn't.
Well, they shouldn't at least.
They shouldn't. I mean, well, and in this case, I think most of them didn't. So, he answered his own question there.
Yeah, that's right. The company the company can't know either where the share price goes. In a different universe, the share price could have been 390. And so individual shareholders would have happily bought at 370. The fact the share price fell to 350 is just one of those things. It is, by the way, and look, I don't love, in fact, I don't like at all, institutional capital raisings where they're given preferential access to larger amounts of capital. On the flip side, the benefit that companies have by raising money with institutions is they can actually lock in a price and a volume and an amount of money up front. Whereas in this case, as you've already said, Billy, you know, shareholders didn't pony up the $10 million that the company was looking for because the price was simply too high relative to what you can buy it on the market for. And so Zip wanted $10 million to do things with. It now has to forego access to that $10 million because it's simply not available to them. So that's the flip side of the same question. I don't like institutional offerings that are not fair for all shareholders. But if you're a company who needs the money, I get why that's an attractive option. And this sort of is circumstance exactly why we sometimes see that happen. Let's move on.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
A question from Paul. Paul actually asked this question a while ago, so my apologies, Paul. We're only getting to it now. Paul says, there seems to be a substantial discount of up to 20% in listed investment companies between the book value of and the stocks these LICs have purchased. Can you understand why this is happening? And can you see any reason why this would not be a buying opportunity? Thank you, Scott and Doc. Full on. Paul, that's a really, really great question. So I'm gonna define our terms, Doc, and I'm going to ask you for your thoughts, and I might weigh in at the end. Dare say you'll probably cover it all anyway, but I'll give it a go. So the first thing we need to talk about is what a listed investment company is. A listed investment company is a business. I don't think we'll see a whole heap of them in the future because ETFs have kind of taken over. But the idea was basically that rather than investing in a fund, sending your check off to a fund manager who ran Scott and Doc Capital, for example, Scott and Doc Capital could list on the stock market as a company, as a stock. In that case, the type of company we would be forming is not a manufacturing company or a farming company or a tech company, but a company that invests. In other words, it's a listed company because on the ASX, and it's an investment company, so therefore it's a listed investment company. Some of the big examples are AFIC, AFIC, and Argo Investments, long, long track records in Australia. Arguably, Saul Pattinson, which I own shares in, is also a listed investment company. It's kind of a bit of a Frankenstein conglomerate in a good way, but it's a bit of everything because it has wholly owned businesses and it does other things. So, but broadly, a listed investment company in the purest form is just a business that exists to invest its shareholders' capital in other investments. So that's what it's for. Now, the vast bulk of those only buy listed stocks. Now, if you have and let's just keep the number simple, what Paul's implying here is, look, there's a listed investment company and it owns shares in just Woolworths because it's easy, and it owns $100 worth of shares in Woolies. So by rights, you'd say, well, hang on, if the company's assets are $100 worth of Woolies shares, and that's all, then the company should trade for $100 a share, right? Because that's the value of its assets. Now, in this instance, what Paul's saying is, well, hang on, the LIC's currently trading at $80 a share. The value of its assets are $100. Kind of A, why? And B, wouldn't you want to buy $100 with Woolies shares for $80? Wouldn't you do exactly that if you had the choice? And that's a really good question. So, Doc, what's the answer to Paul's question?
I don't know. Excuse me. I mean, why that happens. I really don't know. I don't deal with LICs really. I don't.
They're not the sort of growth company and tech company you particularly like.
I don't love LICs. I don't see the point of LICs.
Yeah. Not the current world, no.
Yeah. I mean, I get ETFs. It's like, I mean, maybe this is like some sort of manager discount or something that's being applied. You know, you put. I mean, the assets are current assets, and maybe something happens and, you know, you sell stuff and then you could blow up the... Effectively, you're running a fund, right? I mean, you can blow up the performance and, yeah, I don't know. Yep. I don't have a good answer for this.
Yep. No, good question. There are a couple of answers, Paul, that I've heard expressed, and I'll share them with you. To Doc's point, there is no obvious rational answer, otherwise we'd always, you know, there would be no discount. So to some degree, the only answer is market inefficiency to some degree. Let me give you the other answers though, and we'll come back to it. So the first is that an LIC should, by definition, trade at a discount to the value of the assets it holds. And the reason is because the manager is going to take their cut. Now, without getting again into the weeds we talked about a couple of weeks ago, getting in the weeds of trying to explain calculations in a podcast because it's painful. If you think about, let's say you had $100 in assets and you were going to pay somebody 1% a year to manage those assets for you. Now, if you add no money and you take no money out and the value of the assets don't change over time, the fact that the manager is taking their 1% this year, then next year, then the year after, and the year after, and the year after that should mean that you will redeem. It's almost like negative interest rates, right? You'll get back after 10 years, $90-ish dollars, bit more because it's 1% of a lower asset base, but work with me. Call it 90. You'll get $90 back in 10 years' time. So even though the value of the assets is $100 now, $100 in Woolies shares, if you've got to pay every year a manager to run that business for you, in other words, run the LIC, most LICs don't have huge fees, they don't have huge performance fees either, but they do have some fees. So to some degree, the again, to use the finance term, the net present value of that asset, given those fees you know are going to be taken out of your LIC, you actually should be paying less because you know it's going to cost you more to manage that. If you just own Woolies shares yourself, there's no management fee. If someone's going to own them for you, there is a management fee. And so the value of the LIC should be worth less than the value of the asset. So that's the first logical reason why that should be true. The second reason is, to some degree, the market, you know, unless the LIC is going to cash out that value at some point, there is no absolute certainty that any discount will be closed. Sol Pats, again, I talked about, they've traded at exactly this sort of a discount almost unendingly for a decade. So again, unless they're going to close out that and give the money back, you know, the market has to all of a sudden at some point believe the LIC is worth more than it currently is relative to those assets. In other words, it has to close that gap for you to actually make money on that gap. Just because it exists doesn't mean it's going to go away. Now, efficient markets theory would say it will, because it should, because there's a discount there and the market should arbitrage that away. But again, unless there's going to be someone who takes action to do it, it won't happen. Now, you may remember Mark Carnegie tried to get Sol Pats to break up the cross-shareholding with Brickworks a while ago. And that was exactly for this particular reason. He was like, hey, the market doesn't get this and nothing's going to change. So I want to break this up and basically force a realization of that discount. In other words, I want to force the market to close that gap by separating out the assets. That's one way it could happen. But again, AFIC and Argo and the others aren't going to want to all of a sudden, you know, basically shut themselves down just because of that discount. They're probably never going to do that. So there's no absolute reason why that gap must close. They're the two reasons why it might happen. Would it be a good buying opportunity? Look, generally speaking, I think yes. I mean, if any time you get to buy assets that are cheaper than the going value, that would make sense. If I can buy $100 with the Woolies shares for $80, well, I should do it, right? That's Buffett's, you know, buying dollars with assets for 70 cents. That's exactly what you want to do ideally. And so, yes, there's value in that. Just remember, of course, the gap may not close. Now, if your LIC owned stocks are paying big dividends, that actually improves the dividend yield, and that's really worthwhile, right? So if Westpac's yield is 5%, but it's effectively 6% because you're buying it for 80 bucks or 80 cents on the dollar, for $80 for every $100 worth of assets, that also can be worthwhile. So there's reasons why it might make sense. The very last reason before we move on, because I've monologued for a while, is you have to make sure you actually want those assets in the first place and the market's getting it right. To use the best example, if you'd have bought an LIC that owned Enron shares back in the day and you said, hey, the LIC is, you know, I can buy 80 bucks worth or 100 bucks worth of Enron shares for 80 bucks, that's a great deal. Again, if you could close that arbitrage gap, it is a great deal because you can close the gap, take advantage of the $20 discount and walk away. But if you're holding those Enron shares at a discount, thinking, great, I've done a great deal, I bought these assets for cheap, well, it was cheaper than the market price, but it was still very, very, very expensive. The same would be true of OneTel or HAH or any of those businesses that subsequently went broke. Just be careful. Just, again, unless you can force a realization of the discount or close that discount and get the money for it, you have to want to own those assets and you have to believe those assets are truly worth what the market thinks. We talked about Woolies a couple of weeks ago. If I could buy 38 bucks worth of, if I could buy 38 bucks worth of Woolies for $35, is that a 10% discount? Well, yeah. But if I think Woolies is really worth 20 bucks, well, there's no reason for me to want to buy Woolies shares for 35, even if the market says they're worth 38, because I think over time they're worth even less than that. And so again, you need to be careful. Unless you can make that discount close, you are at the mercy of the market and the value of those underlying assets themselves. How'd it go, Doc?
That was a long one.
You mean thorough and informative?
Very informative.
And thorough.
Very good.
And useful.
Awesome.
Let's move on.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, mate. Next one came from Cameron. I love doing mailbags. You love doing mailbags too, don't you?
I love mailbags. Mailbags are my favorite.
Thank you, Cameron, for your sending us a question so we get to talk and help you out. Hopefully, we'll find out. Hey, guys, love the podcast. Great variety of topics, and it's great hearing different points of view you both have on the topics and questions. This helps me think through my own opinion rather than just accepting what I hear, which we love, by the way. Like we give advice and we give advice that we think people can take directly because that's why we give advice. But we're also big, big fans of saying to our listeners, our members, hey, this is what we think, but make sure you feel comfortable with that before yourself, because if you aren't comfortable with the advice, either you won't take it or you will take it, but at the first sign of trouble, you'll probably sell out in a panic and go and do something else. So Cameron, we love that you're thinking for yourself. It's a course of action we recommend to all of our listeners and all of our members. All right. He says, I have a question for the mailbag section. Well, this is a special mailbag episode, not only just a section, Cameron. This is the big time. Owning Australian shares via direct ownership using a broker, e.g. Phillip Capital, versus a wrap or platform provider like Netwealth, where the platform has direct ownership. I love all the benefits of platform options, like having everything in one place, lower cost of trades, excellent options of funds, access to overseas markets, etc. But I'm nervous about not having direct ownership. Is that a reasonable worry? Now, we should disclose that Netwealth is a recommendation of ours, so let's get that out of the way first in one, at least one of our services. Not mine, but one of our services. So, Doc, there's a whole lot of options here. Let's do them separately. So let's talk first about the benefits of direct or the benefits and costs or risks of direct versus indirect ownership of shares. What is that and why does it matter?
You know, I'll probably be in the minority here, but I see little to no benefit of direct ownership if it comes with huge costs. I'm a big fan of the indirect ownership model, the cost benefits that come with that model. It effectively allows for lower cost of trading, lower cost of ownership, less hassles, and things like that. You know, we are one of the few, I guess, markets which have this direct ownership model. The U.S. is the largest equity market of the world. You know, largely does not have a direct ownership model. Most people own shares via a brokerage where the brokerage holds the stock or shares in trust. We are seeing sort of that model come through here via platforms, which basically effectively are doing something similar, but providing access, as Cameron said, to not just the local market, international markets, different equities, different, funds, and doing that at a low cost. So I think it is good. So I think that's the flip side. I think is that you know if you have direct ownership, then if the brokerage, I guess, goes bust, then you know what happens to your ownership. I think it becomes a little hairy at that point. I mean, effectively, you still own. If the stocks are held in trust for you, then you effectively still own it. So there's that question. But I mean, it becomes a little bit unclear at that point what happens. And I think that's probably the only positive I can see of the direct ownership model.
Yeah, I'm gonna take the other side of that, Doc. Actually, not strongly as much as you weren't strong in your direction either. I won't comment about net wealth particularly because I don't know the structure of their ownership and how the shares are owned. So I will avoid talking about that because I don't want to. Frankly, I don't know and I don't want to cast aspersions. So my turn to say I don't know. I also agree, by the way, that in the US where it's the norm, you're completely, you know, it is what everyone else does and there's no direct harm in doing it. I think it's imperfect and I think it's less ideal than our current structure here in Australia, exactly for that reason that it adds a level of risk that you simply don't need to take. And again, like our kind of not going back to square one we talked about a couple of weeks ago, that very idea of, you know, I'd rather, given the choice, own shares in my own name, and even if I had to pay an extra $10 a trade for doing so, I'd rather do that than have shares in someone else's name. Now, in the fullness of time, it may never have been a problem, and I may have wasted the extra money, but to me, it's that extra cost would be a form of insurance. I just simply feel more comfortable. Now, I should say, like everything, I was reading about the voting system in Australia, about compulsory voting, preferential voting versus the UK this morning, and my instinctive response is always, well, ours is better. And it just, that is natural, right? So because we have it, we think it's better. Because the Yanks have theirs, they probably think theirs is better. And there is a decent amount of just simply, you know, psychological bias going on there. So I need to cop to that. That's absolutely true. But given the choice between someone else owning shares in trust or in a beneficial interest for me versus me owning them myself, having literal, provable, actual ownership that no one can take away from me, I'd much rather have that given the choice, even at a small incremental cost. Now, that said, as I said, I happily invest in the US. They don't have direct ownership there. They also, though, have insurance. And again, that's why I don't want to comment on net wealth or the Australian circumstance because I don't know what insurances or otherwise are in place for Australian shareholders. I am mindful that let's move outside platforms to brokers for a second. We know there have been other brokers who've gone broke and people have lost money because either they weren't held in trust or, frankly, that trust agreement was broken and there simply is no recompense because the entity that controlled the trust also went broke. So having something in trust only works if the trustee can be relied on and is genuinely delivering that. We know, for example, in real estate, you know, a real estate agent is supposed to put your house deposit in trust. If they don't do it, and actually this happened to me, if they don't do it, that can simply go away. The fact that it was supposed to be done or the trust was supposed to be unimpeachable, they'd actually taken the money back out of that trust. So it was put in there, then it was taken out for their use, which apparently they shouldn't be allowed to do. And in the fullness of time, I did get some money back through a scheme that the government ran, and I was made whole on that, which again is that point about insurance and where what claim you might have for those assets should a platform provider or its trustee or its regulated entities associated, whoever owns or controls that trust or those shares, that's the bit you need to be comfortable with. So I wouldn't necessarily completely avoid a platform on that basis or a broker on that basis. I would want to be very, very, very sure that it was a sufficiently secure solution and whatever insurance or trustee relationship or whatever agreements or roles were in place were being fully played out. Opus Prime is the most recent example I can think of in Victoria where a whole lot of customers lost a whole lot of money because they simply didn't have either. They didn't have access to recompense or the systems that were supposed to be in place weren't followed. But in either way, whatever the reason, they actually lost money as a result. And so personally, I would prefer to have direct ownership. But again, I'm mindful that's just, at least in part, because that's what I'm used to. Doc, any follow-up feedback?
No.
Let's move on to Chris's question then.
Value stocks.
Market. Stock market.
Index. Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, Chris is someone that, I won't say I hate Chris. I will say I'm a little bit unhappy because he's less than half my age. And that generally, as I get older, I don't hate young people. I just hate the fact they're younger than me. So let's go. Chris says, hi, I'm a 21-year-old who is relatively new to investing. I made my first investment a couple of years ago. How good's that, mate? 19. Man. but I only started taking it seriously more recently. I currently invest around 15% of my pay into shares. How good is that? Because I'm horrible in capitals at saving money. When I put it into shares, at least that way I don't withdraw it and spend it. Good man. You know what? I assume it's a bloke. Chris, that is awesome because it's absolutely recognizing the psychological biases that we all fall prey to and having that pre-commitment bias to put money outside your range of access is a very, very, very smart thing to do and good on you for knowing yourself. I will note, however, I get killed by brokerage fees with CommSec. I pay $30 a transaction, which is a lot considering my regular investments are relatively small. There must be a better way to do this. I know it would be prudent to accumulate my pays and invest it all at once, but like I said, I'm honestly useless at saving. I have recently gotten a CommSec Pocket and would also like to hear your thoughts on this. The low fees make it very attractive, but I miss the ability to invest in individual stocks. What do you recommend I do at this early stage of my investment journey? It's probably worth noting that my ETFs through CommSec Pocket are performing better than my individual stocks through my CommSec account. This might be a sign to stick with Pocket for now. Would love to hear your thoughts. He says, P.S. I study property valuation at uni and my finance subjects along with your podcast have really got my interest in the investment game. Keep up the great content. All right. And that, by the way, was an Insta question, Doc. Flash the lights, play the sound effects. Insta questions. I'm all about the cool kids, mate. Me and Chris, we're like, you know, we're both cool kids. All right. I might start with this one. Do you mind? And I'll get your thoughts after that. No,
you go ahead. Yeah.
Chris, couple of things. So, mate, you are far, far, far better off getting pounded by brokerage than spending the money on the latest gadget or thing that you otherwise won't value in a couple of years' time and will have taken you away from saving. So, you may be a case of the lesser of two evils, and that might just be paying up in brokerage. So that, you know, if that's what it comes down to, I don't think it will, but if that's what it comes down to, stick with what you've got, pay your brokerage, call it a impatience tax, and then pay it as a cost of keeping your own hands out of your cookie jar. Second thing, mate, what I would do, you're with CommSec, and I'm with CommSec as well, and we've said before, we'll say again, we have no relationship with Commonwealth Bank at all, or CommSec either, specifically. That being said, your CommSec account probably should have come with an account called a CDIA or a Commonwealth Direct Investment account. Now, that account is a cash account, it's a savings account. And yes, you could take the money back out of that, move it in your transaction account and then spend it on jeans or computers or whatever. What do the cool kids do these days, Doc?
I don't know.
What do they spend? No, me either. We're too old.
I have no idea.
Anyway, so yeah, Chris, if you need it to literally not be in any sort of any form of cash at all, then maybe this is not an option for you. But what you can do is take your 15% and rather than buying shares immediately with that 15%, you know, straight away, put the 15% not into shares directly, but into the CDIA account, the direct investment account. What that basically does is it'll take it out of your, hopefully, transaction account. You won't have an ATM card linked to it, or if you do, you can cut it up when you get it. So you know, if you think you might be disciplined enough to avoid spending that money, you could at least use that kind of separate account over there, he says, on audio, making a physical gesture. If it's far enough out of arm's reach that you can't spend it directly because you'd have to transfer it back and you'll stop yourself, then maybe you can accumulate that for 1, 2, 3, 4 pay periods before you then invest that. That'll keep your brokerage lower as a percentage of your investments. That might be sensible. Second thing is CommSec only charge you $10 per trade if you have less than $1,000 to invest. So if you invest $990, they'll only charge you $10 a trade rather than 30. So again, if you can, depending on how big your trades are and how frequently you're doing them, that's another option. Even if you, as it turns out, if you do two trades for $9.90 each, that's still cheaper than doing $1,000-$2,000 trade. So that might be an option if you invest in it's up to $1,000, so $999, I suppose. But if you invest in just slightly sub $1,000 lots, you'll keep your brokerage down to about, you know, less than 1%, which is a win, or just on 1%. So there are two ways to do it. The other is, as you say, Pocket. Pocket is really useful. Look, I don't think – I struggle with this one, mate. So you could say, my ETFs are doing better. I'll stick with ETFs. You could also say, well, while I'm relatively young and investing relatively small amounts of money, because I say relatively small in absolute sense, once you are 60, hopefully your portfolio is 100 times the size it is today, then you're playing with big bickies. For now, it's large relative to your current earnings, so that matters a lot, but won't be – as impactful on your future performance. If you make mistakes at 55, it's going to cost you a lot more than making a mistake at 21. So the other way you could do it is to keep investing in individual stocks at 21 and chalk up some of your less awesome outcomes to simply experience, and that can be just, you know, one of the ways to think about how you buy individual stocks right now. Either way, mate, I have no particular view on that. I think you can probably do better than the market with either your own stock picking or advice from someone like the Motley Fool, which is kind of a quasi ad, but you know what I mean. If you can find someone to help you beat the market, then you're better off if you do that. So that's probably worth doing. But also, frankly, mate, at 21, if you just keep putting 15% of your pay aside for the rest of your life and invest in ETFs, you'll be richer than probably 99% of your mates, quite literally. So there's no harm in just sticking with ETFs if you're more comfortable with that as well. Pocket can be great. Eventually, you're going to have a portfolio large enough that you can move outside Pocket anyway. I think I would probably try and use the CDIA account if you can, and invest in smaller amounts if you need to keep that brokerage down. How'd I go, Doc?
I think you covered it all. There's nothing for me to add.
That's disappointing. Does someone want to say how great my answer was, or how?
Your answer was fantastic. It was awesome.
Shall we move on then?
Let's do that.
All right. Mate, I'm going to give you first go at this one because I'm a sharing, caring kind of guy, as our listeners well know. Mate, he says, hey, Anirban, Mr. Phillips. How exciting is that? Mr. Phillips, they call me Mr. How would you reckon Chaz is?
I didn't get 15, even missed 12.
It. That's right. Well, you know, I've got to take it where I can. What are your thoughts on the sale of Bellamy's to Chinese owners? I have a young baby, and to me, Bellamy's is like the Coca-Cola of baby formula. I like that. I can't imagine the US ever selling iconic brands like Coke. It appears on the surface that China blocked their Chinese expansion plans to lower the share price prior to the takeover bid. Also, what do you make of the high PE? Great podcast, hashtag full on from Chaz. That's awesome. Let's go through the Bellamy's question, mate. So what do you make of the sale to China's owners is his broad question, with the possibility slash allegation that China may have just played around the edges to keep the price down and let one of their companies buy it on the cheap.
Okay. So I'm a little disappointed that, you know, he called Bellamy's the Coca-Cola of baby formula. I was hoping he's going to say A2 milk is the... is the Coca-Cola.
Maybe A2 is the apple of baby formula, mate.
Maybe A2 is the apple. No, that's better.
There you see.
That's better.
I'm helping you out here.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
we'll go after you, Chaz, by the way.
So, look, here's the thing, right? As much as I would like to think of Bellamy's as iconic, I don't think it was iconic.
Be kind.
I'm being truthful. I don't think it was iconic in any shape or form. I mean, here's the thing that people don't realize about Bellamy's, actually. Most of the Bellamy's milk is not even Australian. so maybe the Chinese didn't realize
a victory,
that.
A victory of branding over reality, you reckon?
Yeah, so, you know, it has this beautiful... allure of everything being from Tasmania. But the thing is that a lot of the milk used to come from Chile and South America. So the milk was sourced from South America. it was changed from, milk to powder, but I believe for a long time by this Kiwi company, Fonterra, I think.
Right.
And so the only thing Bellamy's did was put a tin and made it sound it's Tasmanian. So
now, funnily enough, that was at the time.
That was the game.
That was the beauty, right? The beauty of the whole thing was this is a capital light business, no inventory cost, no production cost. So, you know, super capital light, great margins. Worked while it worked.
Yeah.
Until it didn't.
I think somewhere along the line, I think basically I don't know exactly what we could think about it, but basically the Daigou market for some reason dried up. You know, I wouldn't think... personally, I really don't think that there was any form of Bellamy's difficulty started much before the new regulations came around about infant formula export into China.
They did spend about 18 months waiting for this never seemingly coming authorization for the new product, though, right? Others were able to import into China, and Bellamy's seemed not to be able to convince the Chinese government to give them clearance.
There's only one company that has, thus far, only one company that has the explicit approval to send milk, and that's or infant formula. That's basically A2 milk,
right?
So, I mean, you know, it's hard to I find it hard to argue that they did this on purpose. I mean, why they could have done that to A2 milk, right? They didn't do that to A2 milk. I think Chinese regulations might be hard to navigate, and actually, it is it's probably harder to navigate if you don't have foot on the ground, right distributions, right people, and so on. And Bellamy's effectively was a really small company,
right?
And maybe hadn't built the right right tools and processes required to get into that market and navigate that market.
It does seem there is an element of, if not deliberate kind of harming of Bellamy's, there is some sense that in China it kind of is a little bit of who you know, right? Like the boots on the ground, the relationships with the regulators, with the politicians.
Yeah,
I wouldn't say necessarily. And look, it's entirely possible this was all orchestrated, right? There's a chance, but it seems more likely to your point, or sorry, maybe not even to your point, but I make the point that, you know, I think I agree with you. It's probably not directly orchestrated, but there might have been some challenges that Bellamy's and even Blackmores are having around finding a way to access and be successful in the Chinese market without having local knowledge, local relationships, local abilities to just frankly get things done however it needs to be done in China.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, here's another way to think about it, that, you know, this, you know, the brand suffered after the Daigou, you know, think went kaput. And then the brand has suffered for 18, 20 months without, you know, having this ability to. Would you really, if you're a buyer, would you really want to buy something that has actually been out of mind, out of sight in some ways from consumers for 20 months, 24 months? You know, 2 years is a long time in, you know, after, and in this period, there have been so much other competition in the infant formula market. And the infant formula market is effectively a pretty competitive market, right? I mean, it's basically commodity if you think about it, other than the branding effect. You know, everybody from Nestle to, you know, A2 to, you know, so many other companies are doing the same thing. So
and the idea of, so I don't know that America has, does America have any equivalent of our Foreign Investment Review Board? Do you know? I mean,
I think so. I mean, well, I think deals, mergers and deals need to probably be approved, but mostly I think for anti-competitive reasons.
Yeah, because I don't recall, maybe just because the US market's the biggest market in the world, maybe it never happens, but I don't recall the US government stopping anyone buying an American company anytime recently. Can you think of
I think you can be, I think a buy might not happen because of security reasons.
Right.
Or for monopoly reasons. But okay. I don't think there is, but I think it's broadly the same thing here too, right? I mean, the government, I mean, there is a board, but the government would say, okay, you can't buy this because it is a genuine security issue or it's a, you know, it's somehow going to be market dominating issues. Maybe the name sounds like that, but I think the last one that was not allowed was GrainCorp, right? And that was mostly on the ground of it being basically a food security issue.
Yeah, look, yes. I think we can't divorce, because of the realities of life. And again, it's not a political statement, but it is a statement about politics. So it's not a party political statement, I probably should say. To some degree, it is absolutely the story of, there's an element of politics to this, right? So how do we feel about other people owning our grain providers?
Yeah,
I'm a bit jaundiced on this one, only because, so take any of the grain corps, for example, right? The government can provide any regulations it wants on what gets imported and exported out of the country, which may bear no resemblance at all to who owns the company. So if I own the company, you own the company, or, you know, John Smith in Canada owns the company, the Australian government can impose exactly the same regulations, which don't need any, but make any impact on who actually physically owns it. So it does strike me that if there are genuine claims of pure national interests, I don't think people understand them. I think it's far more likely a political reality of how the punters are going to respond to the fact that another Australian company is being sold, rather than genuinely what it actually means for our food security, right?
Yeah. I think I agree with that.
Maybe I'm being too cynical, I'm not sure. Yeah. Look, I think that's right. We had a buy recommendation on Bellamy's when the company was bought by the Chinese. We thought the eventual licensing would come, or was likely to come, that we're happy to make a thesis on the basis of that, plus general growth in demand. I probably, all things being equal, would have been happy for us to retain Bellamy's on the scorecard at Share Advisor for the foreseeable future and let the future play out the way we thought it was going to. Obviously, the Chinese buyer also thought there was good opportunity there and decided to buy the company instead. So it always feels good when someone pays you for your shares at a higher price, because you feel like, well, they're saying I was right. Now, whether that's true or not remains to be seen, how well the Chinese buyer uses Bellamy's to be successful. don't really have a national interest issue, generally speaking. Again, it's the ownership versus the control of the product. I don't really think it matters. We kind of feel a little bit, at some level, emotional about that, even if we pretend it's not a motive, you know, buying our companies. You know, we don't complain when BHP buys a Brazilian mine, but we care when someone tries to buy an Australian baby food maker. It's all a little bit relative. It's probably owes more to our emotions and kind of political learnings than it does to rational economic fact.
And in this particular case, I mean, all they're buying basically is a brand.
Well, yeah, that's it.
Because milk is not Australian.
Now, I will say at some level, what I do think is, and by the way, and again, this is where it's a little bit, and Chaz, I don't mean this about you at all, by the way, mate, but people do, they had the same issues with the Japanese in the 80s and 90s in Australia. Doc, I don't know if you were around then in the country, but we had, you know, Japanese buyers. They bought, you know, Lion Nathan bought Tui's, right, at one point. And it was that sense of, you know, they're buying our beers. And now look, in the meantime, has anything happened? Tui's beer is still pretty good. I drink Tui's old as it happens. And I'm, you know, the beer's the same as it used to be. And I'm more than happy the price has gone up, but that's more tax than product. You know, has the country been harmed by it? Probably not. What I would say is I think we've got to be really thoughtful. If there is a political or a kind of national angle, it's that we can, as a country, as investors, often undervalue stuff that other people with longer time horizons can value, right? Now, when some of the overseas buyers are buying our stocks, it's because they realize that we're undervaluing them. Now, I can't blame them. If they want to pay a bit more for Bellamy's than the Australian market's paying for Bellamy's because they think it's worth more, that's what private equity raiders do all the time, right? That's exactly kind of part of their shtick. You know, if I'm frustrated by anything, it's the fact that we can sometimes sell assets too cheaply because we'll take a 20% bump in the share price from, in Bellamy's case, a beaten down price. They're getting a bargain, right? Because we don't value the full long-term potential of those companies. So I, you know, that's my beef. It's not with the companies that are buying it or even with the government for letting it happen. My beef is with the Australian investors who undervalue these business or any businesses and are letting other buyers, they happen to be overseas buyers, but they could equally be private equity buyers or rich Australians, they're letting, you know, other buyers buy them on the cheap because we don't necessarily understand the value. Should I get off my high horse?
Isn't it better to just answer some questions?
Let's do that, mate. So this is a big mea culpa from me, by the way. This is one I've got to apologize for. So remember a couple of weeks ago I was talking about Hoey and Hoey's question that I said we'd already answered?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out Hoey messaged me and said, guys, you didn't actually answer that question. So either I'm wrong or Hoey's wrong. And frankly, the chances of me being wrong are much higher than Hoey being wrong. So I will apologize to Hoey. Although, Hoey, if you've led me up the garden path and we have answered this question already, then I'm going to come for you. No, I'm kidding. So Hoey basically hit me up on Instagram and said, hey, you said you'd answered this question. You haven't. So here it is. Hi, Scott and Doc. Absolutely love the podcast and listen to new and old ones daily. Howie, get a life, get something else, mate. You need to do more. I'm a keen member of Motley Fool Dividend Investor and Extreme Opportunities. Maybe that's why I didn't answer his question. What's wrong with Share Advisor, Howie? Come on, mate. I run Motley Fool Share Advisor. Doc runs EO. Ed Vesely runs Dividend Investor. You're backing those two blokes and not me. And you wonder why I didn't answer your question.
Maybe that's why he's not, you know, not subscribing. Now that you answer.
Oh, I see. You reckon, there you go.
Now he will.
So Howie's going to do the right thing and subscribe as soon as he hears his question. Good man, Howie. Thank you. Feel free to send me a copy of your receipt just so I know. He says, my question is about ETFs and if you should invest into multiple ETFs and LICs. Now, we've already talked about LICs. We've defined those terms, so that's good. Should you invest in multiple LICs, some of which probably have the same companies within their portfolios, the same for ETFs? Also, if an LIC has a company within a portfolio, would you advise us to also buy this company's stock separately? For example, Treasury Wine Estates, which I own for full disclosure, which is already within the LIC's portfolio that I invest in. I'd appreciate your thoughts on this. Keep up the good work and capital letters, full on. Good man, Howie, despite you not subscribe to my service, I'll still answer your question because I'm a nice bloke.
Yeah, I think you should answer this question because then he may subscribe.
Yeah, but if he doesn't, then I've answered his question in good faith and he still hasn't subscribed.
Exactly, yeah. So I think you should answer the question. My points do not count for this one.
But he's a member of your service, mate. You probably owe him something.
Yeah, but he's asking about Treasury.
All right, let's do it.
Clearly not asking about those extreme ones.
We get this question actually from people, and this one, you won't probably have any overlap stocks between EO and Dividend Investor, Hoey, so you won't have faced this. But we do have we have multiple services at the Motley Fool, and we have members who are members of multiple services, some of which have the same stocks in them. And so they ask us all the time, hey, this stock's in both, what do I do? And this is the same kind of question. I particularly with ETFs and LICs, when it comes to considering portfolio allocations, you almost need to forget about the structure you own them in, right? So yes, you own, let's say you own the ASX 300 ETF, just pick that number, right? You probably as a result own 5% of your portfolio is probably in Commonwealth Bank. Now, if you have another assets outside that, that percentage drops as you go. If all you own is the ETF, 5% of your money is in Commonwealth Bank. Now, if you own half your portfolio is ETF and half is something else, then that means Commonwealth Bank drops to 2.5% of your overall portfolio. So rather than think about the ETF, which exactly is the question, you're asking the right question, mate. You're saying, hey, shouldn't I consider the stocks within it? The answer is absolutely yes. But I wouldn't say that necessarily should exclude you from owning the stocks separately. It's just a question of understanding clearly the way that money is allocated. So if you know that the ETF you own has 5% of its money in Commonwealth Bank, consider that as you decide whether or not to add more money to Commonwealth Bank. If you want a 10% exposure, by all means, have your ETF and then add some Commonwealth Bank separately. You asked about Treasury Wine Estates, same thing. If you like Treasury Wine Estates and you want a greater exposure than the ETF gives you, then by all means, add some more. So think about the ETF as if you own those stocks yourself in proportion, and then work out what incremental or reduction, it's not quite the same, but you get the idea, you want to have in that part of the portfolio. Now, if you own the ETF, you don't want that much exposure to Commonwealth Bank, go and buy other stuff to lower that weighting. So you don't have to be super strict about it. I'm not saying you should go through and compute all this stuff and work it all out and see if I want to get from 5 to 5.5% of CBA or 5 to 4.5%. And so you do X, Y, and Z. I wouldn't at all go that way. What I think I would just do is say, right, if you are happy to have more treasury proportionally than the market has, then absolutely add some in your own portfolio. If you don't, then don't add any more. And think about the two to combine when you think about your total exposure to treasury. I have to say, for what it's worth, though, when you talk about multiple ETFs and multiple LICs, that's where I don't know that you're adding a whole lot of value. So if you own AFIC and Argo, we talked about those in a previous podcast, they're kind of the same. Like they vary slightly, but I think you'd have to ask yourself, why would I have both? Similarly with ETFs, if I've got an S&P 500 ETF plus a NASDAQ ETF plus a Vanguard Rest of the World ETF, well, you've probably got Microsoft in all three. You've probably got Apple in all three. You've probably got Amazon in all three. Now, some you won't. Some are in the S&P and not in NASDAQ. Some are in NASDAQ, not the S&P. But you are kind of doubling up to some degree. And so as you build out, think about the way you want that portfolio to look. Now, the diversification that comes is useful. So if you have NASDAQ plus the S&P 500, just to pick two, yeah, you'll double up on Microsoft, but you'll be getting on one. You get GE on the S&P 500, and you might get, I don't know what's in the NASDAQ, not the S&P 500, Doc. You probably tell me. But you're getting some mix. So I think to some degree, again, think about how they add to or reduce the amount of complexity and diversification on both sides, so that the good and the bad in your portfolio. If the additional value, the additional ownership value, additional diversification value is worth it, then by all means do it. But I wouldn't exclude owning ownership of individual companies if you want to expand them. I would think very seriously about whether you really need multiple ETFs or multiple LICs. They generally are doing versions of the same thing. Add LICs, add ETFs where they improve your portfolio in a particular way. If you want more international exposure, you might add a rest of the world ETF just to get some European and British companies, for example. And yes, you might get some more American companies, but the trade-off might be worth it because you're getting more international exposure. If you want more tech in your portfolio, yeah, if you've already got an S&P 500 ETF, adding Microsoft twice, is it double up? Yeah, but you actually want that because you want the extra tech of a NASDAQ ETF, for example. So in those circumstances, there are absolutely reasons where you want to add to that holding. So do it deliberately. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. Do it absolutely if you want to. Just make sure you know what you're adding and what the impact is on your portfolio. All right, mate, is your member? Add something useful.
I have nothing there to add. I mean, that's all covered.
Dude, come on.
But it's all covered.
You had one job. Howie, apologies for making you wait for that answer. We hope we've done it justice. We hope the result is worth the wait. If it wasn't, well, complain to Doc because he's your advisor. You don't own any of my services. All right, mate, should we move on?
Let's do that.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Any question from Dale? Dale says, good afternoon. I've seen this in the afternoon. Good afternoon, Scott and Doc. Let me begin with what a wonderful, fantastic, remarkable, and whatever adjective the online thesaurus can give me about this great podcast. Dale, I appreciate your efforts, and I appreciate the fact that at the end of the day you just went, oh, and whatever other stuff you can come up with. And that's fine. We don't mind that. That's okay. Thesaurus.com, jump onto Google Docs or Microsoft Word. Jump in I'm sure you can Google synonym for fantastic or synonym for remarkable and get more. So, you know,
I suggest using Bing.
I don't think Bing knows what a synonym is, does it?
Bing.com, really useful.
If you want an inferior search engine, feel free to do that. He says, a question I have is this. This is a good one. What are the common themes in recessions? What areas weather or even excel in depressed periods and stay conservative throughout? I have heard sin stocks sometimes have an uplift, not really my focus. However, companies such as Church & Dwight, he says better known maybe as Arm & Hammer, not only weathered the 2007-08 lows, they actually excelled due to their low-cost products and advertising in the recession. Is this an area that can be fruitful to a portfolio to help it through the storm? With kind regards, Dale. He also says, apologies if this is too much. Nothing is too much, Dale. You know why? Because I get to ask Doc the hard questions. So thank you for the question, and watch me handball this because he gave me grief on the last question. Doc, this one's all yours, dude.
Yeah, so one of the things I like to do when I think about a portfolio is what exposure does it have to, say, the local economy versus, say, the global economy? And one of the advantages of thinking in that form is it helps, to some extent, at least balance out risks that, say, a local economic slowdown might pose to your portfolio. So it has a couple of other advantages. The big advantage being that if a company's market opportunity is only, say, Australia, whereas another company's market opportunity is the whole world, then by definition, the other company has effectively more opportunity. True. Right? That's one relatively straightforward way to get diversification and some benefits of, you know, removing the effects that recession might have. Now, it's true some companies perform better in recessions. Like, I mean, one example might be that, say, a company that deals with used cars, for example. You know, used cars might be more useful in recession environment than, say, new cars. Another thing might be repairs and services for things like, you know, repairs for cars, services for cars, and so on. So companies that are exposed to that might do better in a recessionary sort of environment. They might even see some growth because, you know, people, for example, don't change their vehicles that often. Instead, they just keep their vehicle longer. Those sort of things can help, you know, but my own preference is to sort of think about diversification from a more of a global point of view. And if you do that, then you sort of balance it out. Now, of course, if there's a global recession, then there's nowhere to hide. But that's sort of in that case, all equities basically suffer to one extent or the other. That's what I think I do. I think buying something, I mean, at a higher level, I think buying something just for the sake of portfolio protection is another question. I mean, if you really worry about recession, then you might also think about hedging, right? I mean, you know, a lot of portfolio managers would hedge. There are many different ways to hedge. You can hedge via long instruments, as I described, or you can hedge via some sort of derivative instrument as well. Again, all of these things fundamentally assume, if you're doing active hedging or some other form of hedging, then you're assuming that you have some sort of timing there. And no one could say, well, the economy is slow, but, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to go into sort of a recession, right? So in that sense, hedging could be expensive. So at a very high level, I try to find companies that have growth. If they have growth, then I'm happy with them. If the growth is diversified and global, that's even better. If I feel that the company is too exposed to local economic headwinds, then of course, you know, An example might be, if people are not buying new cars, then you don't want to buy a company that is effectively leveraged to new car sales.
Right.
So that could be something to avoid, for example.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think, Dale, there's a good question to ask about what you actually want from your portfolio. And Doc's point about hedging, volatility protection, all that kind of stuff is a really, really important one. And as I said in the last couple of podcasts, I really am continually mindful of different people have different objectives from their investing. You will almost certainly get a lower return from your portfolio if you're looking to minimize volatility, because you're going to have to make different decisions. The simple reality is that there's a trade-off. There always has been and always will be between volatility and returns. Now, there's a thing called an annuity product, a retirement product, where you can basically trade in your cash for an income stream for the rest of your life. That income stream will be a lower return than you could get if you invested in dividend-paying stocks, for example, at least generally speaking. But it comes with a meaningfully less volatility, because you're just simply saying, well, I'll give you this lump of money. I'll get a paycheck every month, effectively a quasi pension. They even call it a pension in some products. It's one of those things where you just want to make sure that the results you're getting are what you actually want over the long term. If you're someone who does struggle with volatility, if you're freaking out about the chance of a crash, then great question to ask. The flip side is, to Doc's point about hedging, if you'd have had hedging insurance for the last 10 years while you waited for the next recession, you've cost yourself a small fortune, and eventually when it does pay off, you probably still won't make back the money you would have lost in 10 years of insurance premiums that you paid, right? And so that's kind of the reality of this stuff. That's the way the markets tend to work, is you're going to have to trade something off. I personally am not investing myself, and largely they're not entirely for our services, to avoid volatility. We don't want to take undue risk, so we're diversifying, but that's not to minimize the ups and downs. That's to minimize the chance that any one particular event or series of events permanently damages our capital. So I don't want to have overweighting in banks, for example, or retailers or mining companies or whatever, because I just don't think that's a smart thing to do for the long-term returns, not for short-term volatility protection. So I'm not criticizing you for doing so. Absolutely, if you want to have a look at that, Doc's giving you a good list of stocks that you can think about, or different ways you can think about doing it. Just be mindful there's no free lunch here. And so if you're investing in lower volatility companies, we talked about Woolies a couple of weeks ago, they're probably investing in that because they simply want that protection. But the current price and the current yield, the current PE, it's almost certain, I can't imagine a scenario in which Woolies beats the market over the next 10 years from the current price. So you are trading something off to do that. If you can get comfortable with volatility, that's my first preference, because that's going to maximize your returns. If you can't, absolutely no harm in going for a lower volatility option. Just be mindful of the cost you're going to have to incur to do that. So do it by all means. I don't want to be a downer. Do it by all means if you want it. Just be mindful of the trade-off you're going to have to make. All right, mate. Next question, Doc, comes from Freemo on, guess what?
Insta.
Yes. And Freemo's name is Matt. So Matt says, "G'day, Scott and Doc. Just finished listening to the latest bonus mailbag, and I wanted to let you know that I agree with the other listeners who wish there was more of you guys each week." How good's that? I'm going to come and live in Matt's house for a couple of days, just so he's got more Scott. What do you reckon?
I think you should do that.
I think he'd love that.
He'd love it.
It's very kind. Thank you, Matt. "I've listened since the very beginning, and I actually started at the first episode." How good's that? "Which I felt was still very relevant, as you were only a few months in when I found you guys on my Don't Tell Doc iPhone podcast app." Matt, unfortunately, you've got that wrong, mate. Doc loves his iPhone podcast apps. I'm much more an Android guy. So yeah, Doc's happy about that.
I'm very happy with that. Anybody who uses iPhone is doing the right thing.
All right. He says, "Since then, I've told anyone who would listen about your service and your podcast." Thank you, mate. "I've never actually asked a question, but that's because regularly questions are asked, are asked by others and answered either by yourself or Doc. The reason for my long-winded message, however," we're happy with that, especially when you're saying nice things, "is to ask why you have not started advertising during your podcast. I, along with all other listeners, are eternally grateful for the free learning and knowledge you give us each week. However, I realize you're both giving up a lot of time for all of us. And as a businessman and investor, I thought it may well be something for you to think about as you become more and more popular. I listen to a few non-business financial podcasts as well as yours, and the others all advertise to earn some kind of revenue during their weekly shows. Anyway, sorry for the long message, and please keep up the great work. Cheers, Matt." What do you reckon, mate?
Oh, great. Well, I mean,
you know what I love about this? people are listening to this right now going, hang on, they're slipping this one in on the last podcast of 2019. They're buttering us up for next year's advertising blitz that's about to start. And I have to say, while I love that, maybe no one's thinking that, but I want to think someone is. That was a genuine question and not slipped in for any other reason. We have no specific intentions of starting advertising, though. The reality is that, you know, we do do this for nothing, and that plenty of podcasts do advertise our US podcast, throw some ads in. We hopefully will actually have, here is a bit of, again, not intentional, but I've spoken to our techies and we're hoping to have some exclusive deals for our services for our listeners, Doc. So I don't know when, sometime next year probably, hopefully earlier rather than later, we'll actually be able to give our listeners some good prices to join ShareAdvisor Extreme Opportunities. So that was not an intentional ad, and Matt doesn't work for us, I promise. Although maybe, every time Matt that works for us, I don't think it's him. He threw that question in and we appreciate it. We won't do over-the-top advertising, but if people are listening and they're not already members of our services, we might be able to get them some good prices. So there you go. That's some exciting news.
That sounds very good.
Mate, this has been a long one. I'm hoping that people are listening to this probably while they're watching the cricket. So hopefully we haven't taken too much of their time away from them. Hopefully they've enjoyed the last regular podcast for 2019.
That is pretty awesome.
We are going to be back next year. Well, kind of next year. So we're going to be back, of course. But in the meantime, I just wanted to remind people there is a Money Hacks episode coming out. So don't worry too much. There is one more on the 31st of December to finish off the year. But this is our last regular podcast for 2019. Thank you very much to all of our listeners for taking the time. We kind of joke about it, but you know, if you're spending an hour or so with us a week, we really appreciate that. There's plenty of other things you could do. There are so many other podcasts you could be listening to. Don't. Ours is the best. But there are. And we appreciate it. Hopefully we're adding some value to you, but we don't take our listeners for granted at all. We genuinely love these mailbag episodes. We love the mailbag questions and comments because they really do give a sense of what you want to know about, what you want to hear about. I say this pretty regularly, but super, super valuable to us. We really, really appreciate it. Thank you for spending the time. Thank you for those who actually have given us reviews and ratings. I laugh about it, but we very much appreciate both the kind words and also the fact you take the time and effort to go to putting giving us some feedback and letting other people know about the podcast. We have an absolute ball doing it. Doc can't stand me, but I like him, so that's okay. And we have a good time putting it together for you. So thank you very much for all of your support through 2019. We look forward to coming back to you next year with our regular schedule, more mailbag episodes, more regular podcasts, more money hacks, and there might even be a couple of interviews next year. So all coming together, all being put together, and that's the plan. But in the meantime, from both of us, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
And of course, I have to give you the socials. So please do review, subscribe, rate, let us know what you're thinking, tell your friends. If you want to get in contact with us, the usual methods apply. But we did have someone on, if you can believe this, Doc, there was actually a review on iTunes and someone said, great podcast, but I'm only giving it, I think it was 3 or 4 stars because they don't tell me how to get in contact with them to ask questions for the mailbag, which I have to say, I thought I did more than enough. And there are a whole lot of people yelling right now at their listening device saying, you do, stop doing it. But apparently some other people don't know. So if you are so inclined, if you've been thinking about it for a while, if you have questions, comments, ideas, suggestions, other things, please let us know. You can get us on, what should we start with? Start with email this time. info@fool.com.au. Nice, short and sweet. info@fool.com.au. Our member services team get that email. They will send it our way and we'll make sure we get your question or comment on the podcast. If you want to hit us up through the socials, let's start with Twitter because Doc's on that one. @AnirbanMahanti is Doc's Twitter account. I'm @TMFScottP. And The Motley Fool is @TheMotleyFoolAU. Any or all of those. Hit us up. Send us a direct message. I don't know if your DMs are open, Doc, but certainly mine are, and The Motley Fool AU address is open. So direct messages, feel free to do that. Feel free to do it on our regular threads. Tag us on the tweet and we'll make sure we answer your question. You can get us on Instagram, or at least myself and The Motley Fool's account. So @TheMotleyFoolAU. @TMFScottP. That's our Instagram details. Or on Facebook, you can send us a direct message on Facebook, The Motley Fool Australia, and I'm Scott Phillips Money. So now you know, there's no excuse. Of course, one last URL. Leave us your email address. We'll send you some good stuff by going to fool.com.au/MMM.
Triple M.
That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. That's it for this year's Motley Fool Money, at least our regular episodes. We'll be back next week with another dose of Foolish Insight. Happy New Year and full on.
Full on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.